on the court's oral calendar this morning is State of Minnesota versus Wanda Catherine Williams. We're ready for arguments by appellant, State of Minnesota in this case. You may proceed. Please state your name for the record before beginning.
May it please the court, counsel. Terrence Swihart, Assistant Rice County Attorney on behalf of the State of Minnesota. Three issues really are presented before the court today. One is the critical impact, a threshold issue, on whether the state is allowed to bring this appeal and whether that has a critical impact on its case. This is a second-degree murder case that arose out of Rice County. The incident occurred in Faribault, where the defendant in this case was alleged to have stabbed the victim, Mr. Bongers. The second issues are related, and that is really a Miranda issue. And I'm just going to, the district court addressed it as several, one, two, and three initial interviews. I'm just going to say the pre-Miranda interview and the post-Miranda interview. And those are the second issues, really, which are subdivided into two separate ones. Is the first is, was that first initial interview a custodial interrogation that therefore required a Miranda warning prior to the interview. The second was, did the statement by the defendant after that second, when the second interview started, after the Miranda warning was issued, did her statement of, do I need a lawyer, did that statement require the officer then to stop and clarify whether the defendant was in fact exercising her right to an attorney to remain silent. The critical impact, I believe, is met in this case, and I'm not going to touch on that very long, but really the case law here indicates that even in the case in which the suppressed evidence results in the reduced chances or the reduced likelihood of a successful prosecution, that there is critical impact has been met. In this case, the statements or the admissions, if you will, that Ms. Williams stabbed the victim, Mr. Bongers, occurred really in that initial interview or the pre-Miranda interview and the post-Miranda interview. What happened was the officer Karsten arrived on scene at 9:15 to the scene of a chaotic scene. When she entered the residence, there was blood all over. Mr. Bongers was on the floor with Ms. Williams standing over Mr. Bongers attempting to render aid. Officer Karsten indicated that the scene was chaotic. Ms. Williams was hysterical. And Officer Carson indicated, as I said, blood was all over in the kitchen area, all the way to the back hall and in the bathroom. And Officer Carson asked, as an initial matter, did you stab Mr. Bongers? And Ms. Williams at no time admitted to any, that she at all stabbed Mr. Bongers, and said, just simply stating, he came up on me, he came up on me. So in this case.
Mr. Swihart, can I ask you, with regard to that, it seemed like a fairly strong case given those facts, even though there's no direct confession that I stabbed him. So my question to you is, how do you point to a specific significant reduction in likelihood of successful prosecution as a result of the suppressed confession?
Well, and I think I cite that in my brief as the other area is that with a specific intent crime, the statements of the Ms. Williams are relevant to that specific intent crime of whether she intended to stab Mr. Bongers. So I understand there's circumstantial evidence that indicates that she could have caused the injury. We need to prove, though, in this case, that she either had a purpose to kill or believed that her actions, if successful, would kill Mr. Bongers. In this case, merely saying he came up on me. And really throughout the subsequent, that doesn't come in, but the statements really at that time, at the scene, don't provide any basis, really, I don't believe, to establish either second-degree murder or the lesser charge of second-degree assault in this case. So I think her comments pre-Miranda and post-Miranda are certainly relevant and...
Isn't the main difference, though, that she simply admitted she stabbed him?
Yes, exactly.
And so how much more did that show that element than the fact that she's the only one there with the knife there over the body, no one else is present, and he came at me, really add to the burden of proof?
I think it adds a considerable amount. I mean, you have the officer there. The only statement she made to the officer on the scene was, he came up on me. She didn't admit that she held a knife, and I don't know at this point, well, we don't have any evidence of this record, whether her fingerprints were on the knife, other than he came up on me. That's the only statements really we have at this point, and in my view, considerably lacking or is significantly insufficient to prove by reasonable doubt that she committed second-degree murder in this case. So I think in this case that the specific intent crime also to delve into the mind of, I guess, the defendant and whether she intended to cause harm to the defendant is relevant and certainly critical impact in this case.
Well, didn't the interrogating officer state that he thought that she was a suspect considering all the information that he had received, including, you know, all the blood there. There were the only two people there. There was a knife in between the victim, the decedent, and an appellant, and all the information that he received from the officers there.
No, he didn't. And I see in the court's order that she says that the judge says that the officer Alexander believed that the defendant stabbed him. But at no time, I thought that. That was my main mindset as well, that, well, the officer must have said that she was a suspect. But if you look at his report, I think offered as Exhibit 3, in his report he says, I viewed her as a victim when he first got to the scene. So he may have thought that she stabbed him, but he also thought she was a victim at the same time because of the injuries that she sustained. I believe at the scene she said he hit me, or he believed that she had some injuries, and as a result she was also a victim. So I don't think he ever thought she was a victim. A suspect. He may have thought, yeah, she stabbed him. But I think that's different than she's a suspect for a criminal act. There's a distinction in my mind anyways with respect. I don't think he ever, though, said I viewed her as a suspect.
Okay, I thought the discord had said that.
I'm sorry, and if I'm incorrect, I'll let the...
Okay.
I didn't see it in the transcript, and I just looked at the police report before I came in today, and so that's why I just wanted to make sure that I'm pretty confident, but if I'm wrong, it's not the first time. I apologize.
Okay, fair enough.
Could you address the circumstances surrounding the interrogation and whether or not a reasonable person would have believed they were in custody to a degree associated with arrest?
Thank you. So your question, I think, can I first address the initial pre-Miranda? And in the district court's order, and the review here is whether it's de novo by this court. It's the determination.
De novo with a lot of deference.
Yes, but nevertheless, de novo. In this case, the district court relied on five factors. That's on page 9 of its order, the top paragraph, when making a determination that the Ms. Williams was in custody at the time. And this court makes a determination based on the stats factors, is what I refer to them as. And there are six factors there that... a court relies on when making a determination whether there's an individual is in custody. There's also, which I think is interesting, there's additional factors found within Thompson that a court considers whether a person is not in custody. I think that's significant. I think there's two separate analyses. You don't mesh them together and determine if he's not in custody.
Why not counsel?
Well, because I think the case law, the precedent here establishes in all the cases I've read, is that this court and the Supreme Court makes a distinction. They do an analysis of this person is in custody, this person is not in custody.
You cited to the State v. View case.
Yes.
That one, the Supreme Court did analyze both the stat factors and the Thompson factors.
But they did so separately. They didn't just say... And I think that's where the distinction is. They didn't say, okay, we're going to determine if he's in custody. And when we look at whether he's in custody, let's look at whether...
I think what the district court did here was actually follow the View case in terms of let's look at the factors, stat factors, to determine whether or not she is in custody. And conversely, let's look at the Thompson factors to see if there are factors that lean toward the fact that she was not in custody, because it's like different sides of the same coin. The Supreme Court in view took that approach, and the district court here took that, seemed to follow that exact same approach. I don't understand why that would be error.
Well, I think because it's a determination of, just because an individual is not in custody, for example, did the there are overlapping factors. I agree.
Right. For example, you know, is an interrogation taking place at the police station, which is one of the stat factors, versus a Thompson factor, is interrogation, for example, taking place at the person's home.
And then the stats is, did it occur at the station?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are overlapping factors, but just because they're overlapping doesn't necessarily mean that you mesh them all together and analyze them. And if the person, for example, didn't have the ability to make phone calls, that because they didn't have that ability, that therefore means they're in custody. That's not the analysis. And I think that's what
the district court said. With you on that. Yeah. That's analysis. But you seem to pick apart each one without looking at the overall, which is what the district court did. The case law says you look at the totality of circumstances to determine whether or not somebody is in custody and whether it's an interrogation.
Yeah. And I think the other issue I have with the district court's order is that not only did she kind of mesh them together, and I understand your point at this, but she also applied other factors that this court and the Supreme Court have determined they're not relevant. For example, the district court said suspect believed to be under arrest, as indicated by her question to Detective Alexander, but this...
Her subjective
right, and so that's not as you're all aware, that's irrelevant to the determination of whether somebody's in custody or not in custody. In this case, she also said that the defendant did not have access to a phone, but in State v. Flowers, and I apologize, that wasn't in my brief, I can, if permitted, file a supplemental brief with the additional cites that I make here today, but in State v. Flowers, which is 788 Northwest 2nd 120, in that case, a similar argument was made that I didn't have access to a phone and therefore I was in custody. And the court in that case, the Supreme Court said that Stats provides that allowing an individual to receive a telephone call is indicative of a non-custodial interrogation. However, there's no rule conveyed or enunciated by the Supreme Court that says failure to offer an individual the opportunity to make a telephone call is indicative of a custodial interrogation. So there's no rule that says if you don't proactively offer a telephone call, that's indicative of an in-custody interrogation.
Didn't the judge just consider that factor, though, again, using the second six factors noted in Thompson, the sixth one, and the suspect's ability to make phone calls? Wasn't that proper for the court to analyze that as one of the many factors?
Well, again, that's, I think, where Judge Reyes and I are kind of butting heads about, is I don't think the stats, and as conveyed in Flowers, said offering a telephone call or the ability to receive a telephone call is indicative of a non-custodial interrogation. Non-custodial, so you're not in custody if you're able to get that call. Simply because you don't have access to a phone doesn't thereby turn it into the opposite of now you're in custody. And the court says that.
To clarify, though, but wouldn't the clear error be if the court only looked at, let's say, that factor and said in custody, as opposed to looking at all of these factors, balancing them? And the phrase I'm seeing in the judge's order, in fact, when referencing, and this is maybe where you reference it, the flipping the words, in contrast, several of the factors weigh against a finding that the defendant was in custody, which is a different way of saying we have also identified factors that may suspect a suspect is not in custody, and the court then looked at the factors that favor the state's argument. So the point being, isn't that in the phone and the you're not under arrest, it's at the police station, and how she got there, all of those the court was supposed to look at and indeed did, how would that be an error by looking at all those factors?
Well, so then if we go back to those factors and look at those factors, the stats factors, for example, on determining whether somebody was in custody. The police interviewed the suspect at the police station was one factor. And the judge said, the district court said that the police interviewed the suspect at the police station rather than at her home. The case of, it's Sterling case. For example, that's the 834 Northwest 2nd, 162. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case where the defendant bludgeoned his roommate, and there's blood all over the place. And his argument was, well, you didn't interview me on the scene. And the court, Supreme Court at that case said, well, his home was being processed as a scene of a murder and was not an environment conducive to conducting an interrogation. Just like here, there's blood all over. You can't interview somebody at that at the scene. Similarly, they said to restrict their movement by transporting to the station. Again, the case law indicates that transporting an individual to the station does not by itself convert that into a custodial interrogation. It was a voluntary ride that they offered and she accepted, and they drove her to the station. The door was, they restricted her movement because they put her in an interview room. But again, if you look at the video, I'm sorry, my time is up. I don't know if
you'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Your name for the record?
Melvin Welch, W-E-L-C-H.
Thank you. May proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May please the court, counsel. I'm not going to get into anything here in the case except for to address a few of the court's questions. I think they kind of cut right to the heart of the inquiry here. The first issue regarding critical impact, this is a situation where the state has submitted that we need this statement in order to make an argument that the defendant acted with the intent to cause a death. And as a critical impact question is presented by the court and its precedent, it says, if it is substantially likely to reduce the reduces the likelihood of success. And that's not where the inquiry stops, though. It goes on to what is the nature of this evidence as a whole, in particular in looking at the evidence, the inheriting qualities of it, relevance and its probative nature, the chronological proximity, filling in the gaps to evidence viewed as a whole. And that's where the difficulty comes for the appellant in meeting their argument that it does have a critical impact. The court asked appellant, the surrounding factors are strong support for the theory that she was in fact the one that harmed him, and the blood that comes all over the house was articulated by appellant, as well as the wound, nobody else being there. When the initial law enforcement arrives, she says that nobody else is there. She gives a mitigating and equivocatory answer to a direct question of, did you stab him? These are all statements from which reasonable inferences can be drawn that, especially with the equivocal response, that she did attack him or she did cause this harm.
Well, is that really a reasonable inference? I mean, as the state noted, the initial thought was she may be a victim. And especially if she has her own wounds, he hit her several times in the head and the face. I'm not sure if that's a reasonable inference. And given the dearth of information at that time, I don't think there's anything that would support the idea of charging her with intentional second-degree murder. That intent element is, because there's no other witnesses, it comes down to her. And those statements seem to be pretty critical to the state's case to prove the intent element.
And I actually agree with you, Your Honor. You're right that the other information, their perception of her potentially as being a victim otherwise, although I didn't see that that was in the transcript anywhere of the record, but if it was in the police report, so be it. But actually, these statements don't support their theory in the beginning. So right now we have a KEDEC. We have the statement at the scene actually is more supportive of their theory, which is a non-responsive answer to the question, did you stance him? He ran up on me, which is defensive in nature, which is not responsive to the question, which can be seen as mitigating one's culpability. Those are reasonable inferences. As we get into these subsequent statements, and again, we're looking at the evidence as a whole to support the theory of an intentional murder, These additional statements don't support that. So the additional statements that are given as they flesh out and as the evidence at the scene is put together according as with the defendant's respondent's statement, I went into the back room. I was in the kitchen. I was attacked in the back room. Appellant himself just identified how the scene itself was supportive of what would be a self-defense circumstance. Attempting to manipulate the evidence into a way to support a theory of second-degree intentional murder, which, as far as I know, hasn't been challenged for the probable cause here or otherwise, I'm ultimately looking at what has been proffered as the state's theory of intentional murder, which is she says this statement about how she stabbed him. Yes, she does. And the way in which she delivers all that statement is related to the self-defense
your
claim.
Point, if I clarify, Mr. Welch, you're indicating that the state never had sufficient evidence at the beginning and identified her as a victim, and her confession would not dissuade that same inference of her victim, her admission as to why she stabbed him.
That is my position, yes,
and
Your
hence,
Honor.
Hence, there cannot be a significant reduction in the state's prosecution because they never had a, with or without it, a basis for the second degree.
That is correct, Your Honor. And so as we look at precedent says, the whole nature of this evidence, we have to look at, all right, what is the state's theory? How does this evidence support perhaps a different perception? And the fact is, the record may not be sufficiently fleshed out on this issue of probable cause to even support the state's assertion that they have had a critical impact on their theory. Maybe that may have to be something that needs to be discussed further. But ultimately, as we look at what is the impact on their theory, this doesn't have an impact on their theory. In fact, the statements made at the scene, which are equivocal at best, are more impactful for their theory of prosecution than the statements that are removed therefrom. Moving on to the next question, Your Honor, and I don't mean to skip over any other questions indicating I believe that they're lacking in import. I just wanted to get through these different topics while I have time. The next question by Judge Larkin was addressing a reasonable person in custody. And there was much discussion about all these separate factors as it relates to how we can assess the mentality of a reasonable person, their perception of their custodial or lack thereof. And that's what we're attempting to get to the bottom of here, the totality of the circumstances by which a reasonable person can determine if they are or are not in custody. And ultimately, that's what the district court here is doing.
Okay. Counsel, I have a bit of experience in criminal law as a lawyer and on this court, and I'm going to be honest with you. I'm looking at the facts here, and I'm thinking of the case law, and this is not looking like custodial interrogation to me. Can you give me your best argument as to why the facts here? And what I'm looking at is sort of reasonably, you know, she agreed to talk with them. She was told she wasn't under arrest. They're not going to talk in the trailer because it's a crime scene. She's probably too upset to drive herself. They offer to give her a ride. She's in the room, one officer, no handcuffs. She's told she can leave. She's shown the door. She's not, you know, for example, escorted to and from the restroom. She's not prohibited from making any phone calls. There's sort of all of these circumstances often lead to opinions from the appellate court saying no custody. How is this case different?
Well, Your Honor, this case is different in that, well, if I may, and I'll set up my response here, Your Honor. We're attempting to determine whether the police actions, and this is just from the case law, taken with other circumstances surrounding the interview or so coercive, manipulative, overpowering, et cetera, that an individual is deprived of their ability to make an independent decision. And so all these different factors are being analyzed. None of these are bright line. This is custody. Likewise, it is no bright line, you're not under arrest, that they're not under arrest. We're looking at all these factors to determine what is a reasonable person assessing here. Like Ms. Williams' statement, I'm under arrest for second degree or for self-defense, that doesn't mean that she's under arrest just because she perceives it.
When was that statement made in the course? Was that before or after the break?
I think that's a... That was right before the break.
Right before the break,
before the second. A19, I want to say, in the addendum. I can't remember exactly.
I do think that there is some point in this interrogation where circumstances sort of changed and what a reasonable person might perceive would have changed. I'm trying to figure out when was that point.
Sure. And I'm going to take the position, Your Honor, that by the time she gets to the to that first interview discussion with Officer Alexander, she's in custody. And the reason I submit for that, Your Honor, as we're attempting to assess the whole circumstances, law enforcement arrive. She's clearly has blood on her. There's a knife. Did you stab him? There's inquiries about the injury, if there was anybody else at home. She has an evasive answer to whether or not she stabbed him, and she's put in handcuffs. Detention, custodial detention at the scene. I think case law is pretty clear. That's
at the scene or at the police station?
At the scene.
When so you think she's in custodial?
Not custodial detention. Just detention. What is it? I forget the
He's
term.
He's restrained at the scene.
Restrained at the scene.
But that's temporarily, and they didn't do any questioning while she was in handcuffs.
No, and I would, and that was not challenged. I think even that the submission was that this was for determining what's happening at the scene. Secured at the scene for officer safety, for investigation, she's with an officer. She's with an officer until the next officer comes with her. She remains with an officer when her handcuffs are removed. She remains with officers when I'm hearing now she's invited to come along. I don't know that the record supports that there was an invitation and exception or an acceptance, but she's put into a squad car. She's escorted down. She's taken in through the police entrance, not through the public entrance. She's taken into a room. She's sequestered. At all times, she is being walked to and from with law enforcement. She's in the room, left in the room. Room is closed. Law enforcement ultimately comes in. Again, you're not under arrest. Like she's not under, or that she is arrested because she thinks she is, she's not under arrest just because the magical words are stated. We have to attempt to assess what is the circumstances here. And the circumstances here, even with law enforcement saying, you're not under arrest, at the same time she's been held the entirety of the time, the relevance and the probativeness of her statement, I'm under arrest for self-defense, is not because she's saying, oh, you know, this is my perception or otherwise. It's what is the perception that a person would have under all these circumstances that are occurring after somebody's been injured, she's made an inculpatory statement, she's been transferred to law enforcement, she's now in a room where she's closed, she doesn't have access to a phone, everybody's uniformed, officer comes in who's an investigator clearly, starts asking questions related to what was going on that day. The questions that were asked were not merely perfunctory as in, oh, you happen to be walking down the street. No, it was getting into the details. You had drugs. Where did you go to get the drugs? How much drugs were there? How many times did you stab him? Am I going to find more stab wounds on him? What's your relationship to him? Why did you start? These are questions with an eye towards litigation. Stating that they're not does not make it so. And so my submission, Your Honor, I think at the earliest point we can say she's in custody is after she's been in continuous control of law enforcement and placed into a room that's closed and she's sequestered. I think that the circumstances support that a reasonable person would believe that they are in custody at that time.
Prior to any questioning?
Prior to any questioning, Your Honor.
Wouldn't a reasonable person also think, I've just been a participant to whatever extent in someone's death, I'm covered with blood, I'm upset, the police aren't just going to like leave this person sitting at the curb. I think circumstances would change once questioning starts, but I mean, I can certainly imagine situations where all of that would happen, she would be put in the room, and then she would still be treated as a victim.
I can't answer that, Your Honor. I'm invited to speculate. I myself have been in a situation where I've been stabbed and was in a situation where, okay, well, I'm clearly not in police custody, and I wasn't otherwise, even though I was being questioned. But at the same time, this is a situation where, again, we have this initial interaction where there is this evasiveness. So there has been inculpatory information provided, which is one of the factors that's looked at in Thompson.
Mr. Welch, does the audio or visual indicate whether other law enforcement were entering the room or leaving the room, observing the judge made reference to being observations by other officers? What does it show in terms of that observation and the interaction with the other officers?
I unfortunately cannot offer you any additional information on that matter, Your Honor. I'm not certain what the video depicts. I have the transcript of the interrogation or the questioning, but I don't have the actual room video, so I can't offer you any information there, Your Honor. But so at the earliest, my position is when she's inside of that room, after she's been under continuous police supervision with these circumstances, she is in custody. Ultimately, if there is any further point beyond which potentially that converts, it would be at the point when law enforcement begin that questioning with an eye towards litigation, that there's clearly pulling evidence out for the purpose of prosecution rather than merely ascertaining what the circumstances are.
Do you see what I'm getting at?
There
could be a difference in the questioning. It's like, we've got you here because we think you might be a victim. What happened? We want to get your story. And now all of a sudden we're asking questions that indicate we think you're guilty of a crime. Maybe that's the line.
I think it's hard to draw a line there, Your Honor, because there is an art to interrogating individuals. And there are a lot of different techniques that are incorporated. I'm thinking of that case down in Iowa with the individual charged with murder. I can't remember the name. We all read it in our Constitutional Law 101
Christian
class.
Christian burial speech.
I think that's the one with the fruits of the poisonous tree, right? The officer was very empathetic with the person, very understanding, attempt to establish that moral connection. Other times it's, you're here, you got to answer, do what's right. Other times there's, we're just trying to get to the bottom of this. There's a lot of techniques, and it's very difficult to say bright line, this is where it happens. I think that the best we can do in this
We have to identify the point at which a reasonable person would have believed they were in custody to a degree associated with formal arrest. And so is it wrong to say, one of the things you should look at is what kind of questions were being asked of that person? Because wouldn't the questions that you're being asked impact your assessment of the situation in terms of, am I here because I'm a witness to a crime and they want to get a statement from me and I'm free to go, or am I here because I'm now a suspect and I'm under arrest?
I've got 10 seconds remaining. If you'll allow me to give a moment to collect my thoughts and answer, Your Honor, I'd be much obliged. I think the nature of the questions that are inquired at the time an individual is interacting with law enforcement illuminates that consideration. Okay. I do not believe it is I don't think it can be a determinative factor. I think it has to be one of obviously the totality of the factors, because as I said, there are different techniques and there are issues even with getting information in a way now that's okay, that ultimately later can be used improperly, which is what I address in my subsequent argument, the pre-Miranda warm-up, the Siebert issue. And so I don't think that what questions are asked can be a determinative factor, Your Honor. I think that's the best answer I can give to that. And I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Counsel, on the Miranda issue, in terms of the first statement regarding counsel, your argument seems to be that the state properly provided Miranda rights at that point, and that was an adequate clarification of maybe an ambiguous request for counsel. Is that your argument in terms
with respect to the post-Miranda interview?
Yes.
Because
we've got two issues here. Apparently, at two points, she said something about, do I need a lawyer? Should I have a lawyer? And as to the first statement, I understand from your brief that the state's position is, when she made that statement, it was equivocal. The police read her Miranda rights and at that point said, do you understand? And so that provision of Miranda rights satisfied sort of the stop and clarified requirement under case law.
Yes. And as I was preparing for the hearing, or for the our oral argument today, I was looking at the court's order, and I don't know if necessarily that really was an issue that the court relied on. It was the second question of, do I need a lawyer?
Okay. And as to the second question, what's the state's argument in terms of whether or not that was an ambiguity that required clarification before further questioning?
So that's interesting, because if you just read the transcript would suggest, okay, you need to stop and clarify. But if you listen to the tape, that's significant. I think similar to the case of Chavarria Cruz, which I cited in my brief, the as far as the standard of review, I just want to just preliminarily provide this information, is that the factual elements can be discerned from the recording, and you apply the clear error standard of review to those underlying factual determinations, and you listen to the precise words, the volume at which the words were spoken, the volume relative to the suspect's other words, and then the position and what have you. Because in that case, the officer said he didn't hear the defendant.
Well, doesn't the statement, do I need a lawyer, suggest, hey, maybe I want to have a lawyer here?
No, see, that's why I say, now, if you listen to the recording, though, and just apply, listen to it carefully. And it's different than, I think her first statement was, should I have a lawyer present?
Can I have a lawyer present?
And listen to the difference in between that statement and the different, do I need a lawyer? The first statement is, can I have a lawyer present? Not maybe not in that inflection. Can I have a lawyer present?
Is it important, Mr. Sweetheart? It just happened to be here that the Miranda had not been read when she had made the first statement. So the Miranda's read, and according to the case law, if she had said nothing else, we probably wouldn't be talking about that issue. But isn't it appropriate, nevertheless, right after, and I think the court used the phrase immediately following, almost immediately, is that statement, yeah, do I need a lawyer? And so, yet the first statement should have a lawyer present, Miranda, and so that would suggest she's listening to that part of Miranda, and then yet again, do I need a lawyer? Isn't that what the stop and clarify is really all about? While it's not unequivocal, that's the reason we're talking about it under an equivocal standard.
Right.
Between those two, even though you got Miranda in between, and then she asks it again in a different way.
Well, and I think that's my argument is, and which I know the court is
aware. So what will we hear? You're saying, well, it sounds different on the tape.
Yes.
How does it sound?
It sounds, do I need a lawyer? The inflection is different. It's a question. And I think that's the significant part. And if you specifically, and as the court in Chavarria says, listen to the words, listen to the recording. And that's why it's significant, because it's dependent on the content of the defendant's words must have at least subject to a construction that she was requesting counsel. She wasn't requesting counsel, and that's why I'm saying.
Well, but that goes to the whether it's equivocal or unequivocal. I don't think in a Chavarria case, that one it also looked at the totality of circumstances, inflection, how it was said, but I don't think we can just look at the statement in terms of the inflection in isolation. As Judge Sleater appropriately points out, I think we also need to look at the fact that this is almost in direct response to the Miranda warning and following her first question of, can I have a lawyer present? That seems to be unequivocal. Can I have a lawyer present? In other words, asking for one, Miranda, and now she's saying, well, do I need a lawyer? I don't understand why the stop and clarify rule wouldn't apply in that case to stop and ask her, well, wait a minute, the rule is defines itself. Can I clarify are you asking for a lawyer, or are you just asking whether or not you need one? Because those are two, I want to try to figure out what you're asking for, but that didn't occur here. The officer, you know, very quickly launched into the questions again.
Well, and so that's another thing I just want to clarify is that I don't know, and I apologize for disagreeing with you, as it seems quite often here. But
that's okay. I'm disagreeable too.
If you read the recording, I'm sorry, listen to the recording, the officer didn't automatically, he started this questioning, but then paused. There are pauses there. It's not as if the transcript doesn't do it justice, because the transcript would suggest, do I need a lawyer? And boom, he just goes, disregards it, but he goes into his question, pauses. I'm not sure, I didn't count how many seconds, but he does, there's a significant, I would say, pause. But with respect to why not stop and clarify, again, as you're aware, the case law indicates not every mention of a lawyer, word of a lawyer or attorney. It's, if you look at, does the statement, if it does not even arguably suggest that the accused is asserting that she or he does not wish to continue without the aid of counsel, then the continuation is proper.
But doesn't it raise a question under these particular circumstances where she first says, can I have a lawyer present, Miranda warning, and then she says, do I need a lawyer? Isn't that enough? I mean, just looking at those three factors right there in this particular situation, is that enough to raise the concern from the officer in a reasonable officer that, well, I better figure out what exactly she's asking. I'm not clear.
If I may reply?
Sure.
Thank you.
Please.
Thank you. I think if, again, in context, with respect to the first statement, she understood, can I have a lawyer present? The second question, the second statement is a question, do I need a lawyer? So if she were, arguably, as you indicate, someone could be review that as equivocal or ambiguous. But in this case, I think the listening to the recording indicates that it was clearly a question when read in context with the defendant knowing, can I have a lawyer present, or the question, or should I have a lawyer present, is different than that statement. And that's why I think in this case that the continuation of the questioning was appropriate. I'd ask the court to please reverse the district court's order. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your arguments and your briefing. The matter is submitted. You'll have a decision within 90 days as required by law. That concludes the court's oral calendar this morning. Thank you.